Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. It's right at the end of January of 2021. This episode will come out in a few weeks. I have been buried recently by folks saying, here's a reliability plan. What do you think? And it's some of it is medical devices. Some of it is a startup company saying, hey, we need to double check our stuff. Some big companies, some small companies. But in the last 2 weeks, I've looked at probably 8 plans for reviews. And I know that you've developed plans and you have great stories about plans and what to include. And apparently the story I laugh at every time you tell it is you were asked to create a reliability plan. So you did a bunch of research and found every single thing you could possibly do and listed them out. I'm sure you remember that.
You get an A for being thorough.
That's true. But then they said, all right, you only get $3 and 2 samples. So deal with it. And so I get one of the things that struck me is that most of the plans, not all of them, but most of the plans I saw were basically using, we do this test because we always do this test. And we do FMEA because we always do FMEA. It was kind of that philosophy approach to it. And there's some basic questions that you need to ask before you include an expenditure, which it is, of running an activity or a task or a test into a plan. And that usually stops, that usually starts the discussion with these folks of, well, why do you have this here? And I've been approaching that a couple different ways, but it's getting kind of overwhelming to me is that, come on, you don't just do stuff just because you always done it.
You don't. And what's interesting here is I got some analogies that are going on in my brain right now, but you and I would not start with a plan. We would start with a gap assessment or a discussion about your strategies, your vision, mm-hmm. Where you want to head. And there's all kinds of preliminary things that need to be done before you get to a plan. And it reminds me, the analogy I was thinking of is FMEA. Mm-hmm. When I'm teaching FMEA, people often say, okay, so we got an FMEA team meeting coming up, and then they basically haven't done all the preparation for it. And so they want to know what to do in the meeting. I say, well, you need to do the preparation before you have the meeting. There's things you need to settle on and agree on and discuss and prepare. And so the other analogy that I always use in my teaching is painting a room. And most everybody has painted a room at some point. And I say, well, how much of your time is spent planning for painting the room or organizing or preparing, yep. basically preparing, versus how much time are you putting the paint on the wall?
Right.
And that sort of brings out the message that it's the preparation that has to be done well. And the same thing for a reliability plan. If you haven't prepared the right steps, your plan's not going to be very good.
Well, I totally agree, and I'm looking at some walls that, yeah, I could probably put some paint on it, but I know how much work it is, so not the actual painting part, but it's the taping and sanding and all the other stuff that goes into it. I got other things I need to go work on. So I see a couple different pieces in the plans I've been looking at lately. One of them is that it's just a list of tests. It's like we're going to do this environmental test, that we're going to do a transportation test according to the standard, and we're going to do this test according to that standard, and then we always do this test, so we got some samples going to that, and then we are going to do 2 accelerated tests on the overall system. And I'm like, okay, let's back up a little bit, think about this.
Yeah.
And so the very first test in one of these discussions, I said, who needs the results from this? And they're, I don't know. Well, if you don't know who needs the results, then how do you know to what degree that it should be done? You know, how important is it to them? Is it even necessary at all? You know, if you've got unlimited resources, yeah, you could do all kinds of stuff, but I'm sure you don't. Who needs this information and what decision are they going to make based on it? And that usually stops the, get a long pause at that point. Now, but prior to that is, you know, one plan struck me the other day is, well, we've got this one is going to replicate 3 months of use, this activity, this button pushing essentially. And then we're going to take it, take it outside and leave it in the sun to replicate 6 times per year that occurs and over a 7-year period. And so they had 3 months, a year, 5 years, and 7 years. But nowhere in the document did it say how long they expected this thing to last.
Oh, that's so common, Fred. I was teaching a class a couple weeks ago with a group, and we were basically talking about it was in an FMEA class, and we were on the occurrence ranking. Now, the occurrence, by definition, mm-hmm. is the how often the part will have a particular failure mode and cause
right.
over the design life of the product. And so I said, what's the design life of the product? And they said, well, we haven't decided. Well, then you can't do an occurrence ranking. But it's that type of questioning is so important. You have to know a number of things, and it really comes down to the definition of reliability. You have a time factor has to be there. You have the conditions of use, the environmental conditions. You have the duty cycles. All of that
yep.
is embedded in the definition of reliability.
Yeah. No, and it's one of those things that it's part of that prep part. What are we trying to achieve? And so is this and the hard part I find that I think a number of people stumble on is that the overall objective, the reliability definition, I mean, there's too many assumptions there. Make it explicit. Just write it down. And then for like the duration and probability, I often preach that, well, some people really care about the out-of-box time frame, you know, the early failures. Others, part of their design really doesn't, just makes it robust for knocks and shocks and bumps and transportation and being dropped off the counter and things like that, random type overstress situations. And others are concerned with the wear out. They're selecting capacitors or elements that are going to experience multiple uses or repeated uses, things like that, and they would tend to wear. So why not have 3 goals that allows all 3 of them to have a target to shoot for? Because if I have a 7-year product or a 10-year product and it's, you know, 90% should survive 10 years, well, the person that is concerned about how the installation type of stresses that are applied, how do they interpret that? You know, can I use up 9% of that 10% value? Is that part of my allocation, or how do, you know, what do I do with this?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So it's
not a question for you, Fred. I'm going to throw this back at you. When we opened up this podcast, you were talking about having received a number of reliability plans mm-hmm. and taking a look at them. And the discussion then went right around testing. And I'm wondering if those were test plans or reliability plans, or were the clients thinking they were the same?
I think it's that latter one, is that it was the reliability plan was confused with the test plan.
Oh, okay.
In so many cases. And I think that's a common misconception about reliability engineering, is that, no, it's not just testing. It's
it is. If we're going to focus on or put the proper emphasis on design for reliability, we have to get the terminologies right. And I know you know this, but I'm just saying to the listeners, if people talk about a reliability plan and then just discuss testing, you're missing a huge portion of the whole cycle, the whole process of achieving reliability, where you have to design in reliability before you test it.
Right. And, you know, part of it, and I understand why the confusion exists. And I've worked with like an electrical engineer I'm picturing Ed, and he's got, well, there's two things I could do here, two different circuit paths, you know, circuit designs I could do, but one of them is going to constrain how I can put stuff on the board. I'm running out of real estate, but the other one is going to be a little bit hotter, but I don't know how that's going to impact the overall performance, you know, the assemblability and the performance of it. And it was a cost-benefit trade-off. And so part of that we could do analytically and help them, you know, understand the impact of increasing the heat on this particular heat-sensitive component. And did it put us over the threshold that we really needed to some kind of cooling, which then are really complicated? Or we have enough clearance for these capacitors from the screws so that it's unlikely they're going to crack. You know, so we did, while it's not a technical reliability estimation or prediction or anything else, so I had two specific problems that we had knowledge related to failure mechanisms that we were concerned about and went off and did some analysis. And then it ended up being we made both designs and experimented with them because it was a big deal. It ended up being a high dollar decision. So we went back to the lab and we did some testing, but it was started with Ed saying, I got two options here and I'm not really sure how to trade them off. And it was, okay, let's go figure it out. And then we went to the lab. Then we went to testing. As opposed to what I'm seeing is that here's a list of tests and it's disconnected from Ed. He doesn't know what to do with the results when he gets them.
Yes. Yes. Well, and you're saying, I completely understand what you're saying. And my mind is saying to people then, let's balance, if we're getting a reliability test plan, then let's balance and start at least talk to the audience here of what we recommend is to start with the what we call the primary steps to achieving high reliability. So mm-hmm. I want to put a plug in for that. the creating an effective reliability plan is step five in our six-step process. And if you have, as a listener, if you have a test plan, that's really part of step five. That's a portion of it. But then what's step one, two, three, and four? You can almost do a little quiz here. What would be, if you're a listener, what do you think those steps would be? What do you do before you create that reliability plan? And the subset of that is a test plan. What are the steps that go into it as part of preparation? And I'll just throw them out here. The first thing that Fred and I talk about in our upcoming book is develop the reliability strategic vision. And in other words, know where you're going before you try to get there. And so we have a whole chapter on the strategic vision. But then we say, okay, so now we know where we're going. Where are we today compared to where we need to go? And we call that the gaps. So we have a gap assessment. And that still isn't enough because then we have a chapter on identifying key program decisions. So we need to know not only what the vision is to where we're going, what the gaps are, but what are the primary decisions from a program standpoint that need to be made. And then we can start selecting reliability methods. And those methods, some of them will go into testing. Some of them will go into design for reliability. And in other words, there'll be different tools for different decisions. And all of that's before we get to the what tests we're going to run. So I just wanted to lay out for people that Fred and I have a lot of thinking about this, that you certainly don't want to start with the last portion of it. You want to start with the right sequence.
That's right.
So how's that for putting a little plug in?
There you go. I like it. Yeah, and you can find it on Ascendo Reliability underneath eBooks, I think is a drop down there, and it goes to the REM Reliability Engineering Management. It's our placeholder title for it. And it's free. You can sign up for it, and you'll get notices when anything new comes out. Or we certainly are, I've lost track of how many comments and bits of feedback we've gotten so far to improve the book, but But it's been top of mind for Carl and I recently, and I've been in practice the last couple of weeks or 6 weeks now of implementing this, is if you're going to do something, it should really, really connect to a decision that somebody needs to make. If it doesn't, it's then, is it just for the record? You know, why are you doing this? There's a whole different topic of, well, are you using the appropriate tools? And is thinking through, if you're going to put something into a plan, is it going to be sufficient to help that person or meet the requirements of what information is needed? One of the plans I was looking at back in December, a document I was looking at, was in amazing amount of detail. And very clever at how they were trying to quantify that they're meeting a 5 nines reliability over, I think it was 3 years for this device. Now, that's a challenge in the best of circumstances.
Exactly.
Right? And they had hundreds of samples. It is a relatively low cost, one use type thing. So they had, unfortunately, it was to really test it, does it do what it's supposed to do? It's a destructive test. It's a one-shot kind of device. But they wanted to determine and show that its functionality was good. And for example, there's one critical element of the product that had, it was molded parts, and there was, think of a syringe, and there was amount of travel that was allowed to occur in order to create the specific dosage that gets injected. Mm-hmm. And so there is these two critical parts that if they're molded correctly, then the travel will be constrained to in this realm. And I thought, okay, it's fine. It's a critical design that was identified early in the design process that this is critical to the functionality of it. It's tied to that. And then they did some very specific types of measurements and analysis and said, was this in specification or not? And then they went off into a CPK for the two separate dimensions and said, well, if it's in spec, it'll be good. You know, they both have to be in spec. And so we can back out what's the probability of these one or the other part being in specification. And I looked at it for a minute and I says, well, wait a second. It's the interaction of these two parts that have to work.
Right.
Right. And there's latches and catches and a couple other parts like that where there's two different parts that individually, yeah, they need to be in spec for it to overall work. But what if they're both right on the edge? Right? What's the interaction term here of the likelihood of this doing? Why don't we use a Monte Carlo approach saying, well, we know the distribution of all your measured parts for this molded part, this feature, and we know all the you measured a zillion of these things over here, and you have that distribution. Why don't we do a Monte Carlo and make 100,000 of these in an analysis and say, how often do they catch? Does this work? Does it get the right dosage? And so they went off and did that, and it was way better than the analysis they were doing. Not better in that it was more accurate. It was very, very unlikely. I think one of them, I was limited by the tools we were using, that it was like, there's a one chance in 10 to the minus 300 that this wouldn't work.
Right.
And so the analysis they did was more conservative. They ended up with a higher number, that, you know, like 10 to the minus 9th, I think is where they were going. But it wasn't quite the right analysis because it was ignoring the underlying assumption of this interaction term. And so sometimes it's thinking through when we're setting up a plan, especially in this case, it's a 5-9 single use type product. If I would have just done binomial-based pass-fail testing, can you imagine how many samples we would need?
Unrealistic.
Yeah, it'd be in the millions of samples to do this. And so one part was they really did think through and sort out, well, how can they get to... They broke down their product like in a fault tree, and they said, all right, well, if this part's not working correctly. We control that in the molding process. We can measure the variability we got there. We can determine an estimate. And that's great. I love that. But it's also then a little, get a different view of it and go, wait a sec, these are two parts that interact. I got to do a different tool because I have to be able to account for this interaction piece. And part of what they ran into is they didn't go with the assumption that the parts were independent. And so a fault tree, often the base events are considered independent of each other. If it fails, if it does what its occurrence rate is separate from anything else occurring. And that's not, you got to think that through pretty carefully. And it was,
yeah, you do.
That was part of it.
I mean, you can include in fault tree some type of dependency, but that's if you get the right gates.
Right.
But I was thinking also, Fred, I completely agree. You can look at a problem like that and you can simulate to get your answers in a much less expensive way than trying to test a extremely high number of samples. And so that type of Monte Carlo simulation is useful. Another approach, I just finished an article on Inside FMEA mm-hmm. series on, in fact, it's coming, it's coming out in 3 days. But it's on robust design and FMEA. And so another approach is to say, all right, if we have this level of variation, maybe that's not, those tolerances aren't good enough. But there might be a way we can desensitize the design to the anticipated variation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole subject of robust design that has been flourishing in certain sectors.
Yep.
And it can save a lot of money because sometimes controlling the tolerances can be very expensive. And so that's another technique. But it all comes back to what I think you were going with this is the decisions that you have to make. You have to make certain decisions, and then you select the tools to support the decisions you're making.
That's right.
And what we don't want to do is just automatically use what we've always or do what we've always done. And so we'll call that the wrong way. Pull out some handbook or last year's reliability plan or something and automatically use a canned set of tools. You really need to think about what the decisions are. And frankly, Fred, I think that's like a breakthrough for me. I think it's a breakthrough in thinking on how to develop a really good reliability plan is to make sure you get those decisions interspersed into your selection process.
Yeah, certainly agree. So I think we're just scratching the surface of this one, but it's one of those where it's, I'm very curious if in the listeners, if, you know, how do you step into creating a reliability plan? How do you avoid doing a lot of activities that have very low possibility of value? And that's how I frame it. If we make a good plan, one, we achieve our reliability objectives, but two is that we actually add value with each of the tasks that we work with the team on. And so, you know, if you've got some insights on this or ideas, one is go check out our draft of our book. I think we've got, 6 or 7 chapters out of our proposed 10 up there. We're working away at some of the other ones, Carl more so than I am at the moment. And that's on ascendoreliability.com/ I don't know what the name of the URL is there, but you can find it on the menu underneath eBooks. There's a drop down and it does REM.
There's a Go and an SOR in there.
Well, the Go SOR is to provide feedback to us directly. So that's the second call to action.
Oh, that's right.
But I'm going to say, hey, let's skip that for now. Go check out the book. Let us know what you think. We're still looking for comments and feedback as we go through on some of the existing chapters. We're going through and addressing the comments. And it's been enlightening and humbling. There's a lot of talent out there. And the other piece is that we're trying to make it so that it is actually useful reference or resource for you. So your input is just critical to us. Plus, hopefully it presents the way at least Carl and I are thinking about this stuff, which hopefully then will resonate with you and allow you to create a much stronger reliability program and detailed plans. So I'll leave it at that one. How's that, Carl?
Very good. I like it.
All right. Cool. Well, I'll talk to you again soon, Carl.
Talk to you soon, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.